the conspiracy theory that the CIA or other intelligence agencies created Bitcoin emerged shortly after its introduction in 2009. Bitcoin was presented to the world through a white paper called Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, authored by the enigmatic figure known as Satoshi Nakamoto. The mystery surrounding Nakamoto's identity has fueled speculation, leading some to theorize that he could be a government operative or part of a larger intelligence operation. Join me, Josh Reeves, in my 41st documentary, Spookcoin. Did the CIA create Bitcoin? Proponents of this theory argue that if the CIA created Bitcoin, it would provide the agency with a mechanism to control a new form of currency that operates outside the traditional financial systems. This could allow for surveillance of illicit activities while simultaneously creating a financial instrument that could be manipulated for strategic advantages. Some theories suggest that cryptocurrencies, despite their decentralized nature, could enable enhanced tracking of financial transactions. If Bitcoin was developed by the CIA, it could have been designed to appear decentralized while still allowing intelligence agencies to monitor financial movements of individuals, particularly in the context of illegal activities, and it could be used to fund covert CIA operations as well. By introducing cryptocurrency, the theory posits that the CIA could undermine traditional banking systems and other competing financial systems, particularly in nations viewed as adversarial to the U.S. This could destabilize economies and create opportunities that align with U.S. strategic interests.
The main reason I'm here is to clear my name that I have nothing to do with Bitcoin, nothing to do with developing. I was just an engineer doing something else. Okay. And if you look at the time span, 2001, when it was supposed to be developed, I wasn't there. I was working for the government through a contracting company. That's not me. I never communicated with Bitcoins.
Okay.
Leah wrote all this?
Yeah.
2010 to 2000. I was at home.
Okay.
I wasn't working for anybody.
Okay.
I just believe that somebody put that fictitious name in there.
Mm-hmm.
Satoshi Nakamoto and Bitcoin. Or Bitcoin.
Do you think it's...
So, but back to AI, and to this question of intuition, you don't think that it's inherent. So, in other words, if my life is to some extent governed by technology, by my phone, by my computer, by, you know, all the technology embedded in like every electronic object, you don't think that makes me trust machines more than my own gut?
You can choose to, and I think a lot of people are being guided to do that. But ultimately, you're giving away a lot of freedom. And you know, it's not just me saying that. There's like a huge tradition of hackers and computer scientists that kind of started ringing the alarm bell like really long time ago about like the way things were trending, which is, you know, more centralization, less, you know, diversity of competition in the market.
Yes.
And you have like one global social network as opposed to many. Now it's actually getting a little better. But and you had a lot of these people, you know, start, you know, the crypto movement. I know you were at the Bitcoin conference. Yes. Recently, and you told them CIA started Bitcoin. They got really angry on Twitter.
But I don't know that. Yeah, but kidding. Until you can tell me who Satoshi was, right. I have some questions. What?
Actually, I have a feeling about who Satoshi was, but that's a separate conversation.
No, it's not. Let's just stop right now because I'll never forget to ask you again. Who is Satoshi?
There's a guy, his name is Paul LaRue.
By the way, for those watching and don't know Satoshi is the pseudonym that we use for the person who created Bitcoin, but we don't know.
It's amazing. You know, it's this thing that was created. We don't know who created it. He never moved the money, I don't think. Maybe there was some activity here and there, but like there's like billions, hundreds of billions of dollars locked in. So we don't know who the person is. They're not cashing out. And it's like pretty crazy story,
that's
right?
That's amazing. So Paul LaRue.
Yeah, Paul LaRue was a, you know, crypto hacker in Rhodesia before Zimbabwe, and he created something called Encryption for the Masses, EM4, and was one of the early. By the way, I think Snowden used EM4 as part of his hack. So he was one of the people that really, you know, made it so that cryptography is accessible to more people. However, he did become a criminal. He became a criminal mastermind in Manila. He was really controlling the city almost. You know, he paid off all the cops and everything. He was making so much money from so much criminal activity. His nickname was Sletoshi with an L. And so there's like a lot of, you know, circumstantial evidence. There's no like cutthroat evidence, but I just have a feeling that he generated so much cash, he didn't know what to do with it, where to store it. And on the side, he was building Bitcoin to be able to store all that cash. And around the same time that Satoshi disappeared, he went to jail. He got booked for all the crime he did. He recently got sentenced to 25 years of prison. I think Judge asked him, like, what would you do if you would go out? And he's like, I would build an ASIC chip to mine Bitcoin. So look, you know, this is a strong opinion, loosely held, but it's just like there's...
So he is currently in prison.
He's currently in prison, yeah.
In this country or the Philippines?
I think this country. Because he was doing all the crime here. He was selling drugs online, essentially.
Huh. We should go see him in jail.
Yeah, yeah, to check out his story is fascinating.
I'm sorry, I just had to get that out of you. So I keep digressing. So you see AI, and you know you're part of the AI ecosystem, of course, but you don't see it as a threat.
No.
Do you? No.
No, I don't see it as a threat at all. And I think, and I heard some of your, you know, podcasts with Joe Rogan, whatever, and you were like, oh, we should nuke the data centers.
Yeah.
And
I'm excitable.
Yeah.
On the basis of very little information.
Well, actually, tell me, what is your theory about the threat of AI?
I want to be the kind of man who admits up front his limitations and his ignorance. Mm-hmm. And on this topic, I'm legitimately ignorant, but I have read a lot about it, and I've read most of the alarmist stuff about it. And the idea is, as you well know, that the machines become so powerful that they achieve a kind of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And they, though designed to serve you, wind up ruling you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really interested in Ted Kaczynski's writings, his two books that he wrote. Obviously, as to say, ritually, totally opposed to letter bombs or violence of any kind. But Ted Kaczynski had a lot of provocative and thoughtful things to say about technology. And it's almost like having live-in help, which, you know, people make a lot of money. They all want to have live-in help. But the truth about live-in help is, you know, they're there to serve you, but you wind up serving them. It inverts. And AI is a kind of species of that. That's the fear. And I don't want to be a slave to a machine. any more than I already am. Yeah. So it's kind of that simple. And then there's all this other stuff. You know a lot more about this than I do, since you're in that world. But yeah, that's my concern.
That's actually a quite valid concern. I would like decouple the existential threat concern from the concern. And we've been talking about this of like machine, like us being slaves to the machines. And I think Ted Kaczynski's critique of technology is actually one of the best.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah,
I wish he hadn't killed people, of course, because I'm against killing. Yeah. But I also think it had the opposite of the intended effect. He did it in order to bring attention to his thesis and ended up obscuring it. But I really wish that every person in America would read not just his manifesto, but the book that he wrote from prison, because they're just so, at the least, they're thought-provoking and really important.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, briefly, and we'll get to existential risk in a second, but he talked about this thing called the power process, which is he thinks that it's intrinsic to human happiness to struggle for survival, to go through life as a child, as an adult, build up yourself, get married, have kids, and then become the elder and then die, right?
Exactly.
And he thinks that modern technology kind of disrupts this process and makes people miserable.
How do you know that?
I read it. I'm very curious. I read a lot of things, and I just don't have mental censorship in a way. Like I can,
I love that.
I'm really curious. I'll read anything.
Do you think
anyone
being from another country has helped you in that way?
Yeah. And I also, I think that just my childhood, I was like always different. When I had hair, it was all red. It was bright red. And my whole family is kind of, or at least half of my family are redheads. And, you know, because of that experience, I was like, okay, I'm different. I'm comfortable being different. I'll be different. And, you know, that just commitment to not worrying about anything, you know, about conforming, or like it was forced on me that I'm not conforming just by virtue of being different and being curious and being, you know, good with computers and all that. I think that carried me through life. It's just, I get like almost a disgust reaction to conformism and like mob mentality.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I had a similar experience in childhood. I totally agree.
Some proponents believe that a long-term goal of the CIA could be the promotion of a cashless society where all transactions are digital and monitored. This would enhance the government's ability to surveil their citizens, control economic behavior, and combat tax evasion. The anonymity surrounding Satoshi Nakamoto has led to considerable speculation. Some theorists argue that the government would prefer to keep the creator's identity hidden to avoid scrutiny. They suggest that the lack of transparency is suspicious and could indicate a government connection. Bitcoin's technology, particularly its blockchain, is seen as highly sophisticated. Some theories argue that such a breakthrough could not have come from an individual or a small group without significant resources, like those available to an intelligence agency such as the CIA. They claim that the technology's complexity supports the notion of government origin. The launch of Bitcoin coincided with the global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, a period marked by widespread distrust in traditional banking systems. Some theorists believe the CIA could have seen an opportunity to create a new form of currency that would appeal to disillusioned individuals, thereby steering economic behavior in ways that serve U.S. interests. Bitcoin's early adoption by the Silk Road and other illicit markets has contributed to the perception that it is a tool for illegal activities. Some theorists believe that the CIA might have orchestrated this narrative to justify increased surveillance and control over cryptocurrency transactions. And the fact that if you sell any Bitcoin, it's reported to the IRS is also highly suspicious. When I first heard about this theory, I pretty much thought it was bullshit, but it is intriguing, and it's essential to consider several significant counterarguments for the theory. Bitcoin emerged from the collective concerns and innovations of various individuals who sought to create a decentralized digital currency. This grassroots origin theory challenges the notion that it could be a top-down operation by a government agency. However, it is possible it was created by someone who later was co-opted by the CIA. The early cryptocurrency community was largely driven by ideals of decentralization, privacy, and financial freedom. Many early adopters were motivated by a desire to escape government control and establish financial systems, which runs counter to the idea of a government-sponsored initiative. However, if it was a CIA operation, they would want you to think exactly that, that it was a grassroots thing, when in reality, it's another one of their ops.
This is something I inherited. My predecessor had started this, but have set in motion a number of different projects focused on cryptocurrency and trying to look at second and third order consequences as well, and then helping with our colleagues in other parts of the U.S. government to provide solid intelligence on what we're seeing as well. We're also trying to strengthen the cadre of experts that, you know, we have at CIA and develop better connections to experts and people who understand the field very well on the outside as well. Because, you know, I've thought for a long time before I came to CIA that these are challenges that we need to pay attention to because they're going to have enormous impact. They could have enormous impact on everything from ransomware attacks, as you mentioned, because one of the ways of getting at ransomware attacks and deterring them is to be able to get at the financial networks that so many of those criminal groups use as well.
So that's a lot to digest there. Basic essence of it all is the CIA is really investigating this stuff. There have been a lot of conspiracy theories across crypto Twitter saying, like, did they invent Bitcoin? A lot of jokes saying, like, what is the most likely project that is a CIA plant out there? Like, is it SafeMoon? Is it Dogecoin? So some funny things being thrown around. I'll throw it to the group for your take on all of this. Will, how surprising is it to you that the CIA is deeply involved with cryptocurrency?
Surprising. I wouldn't say it's surprising. It's interesting that they would reveal that, though. I think most people would guess that at least one of or multiple government agencies has some sort of crypto project going on. But the fact that he said it on stage is definitely interesting and notable. And of course, it's been just like a part of Bitcoin for years and years and years that the NSA created Bitcoin, that the NSA had some sort of hand in it or one of the other government agencies. And the NSA did invent the hashing algorithm that is behind Bitcoin, SHA-256. So there is some truth and validity to it. I think a lot of people just have some questions about how Bitcoin came out, with Satoshi Nakamoto being pseudonymous. Who is that person or who is that group of people behind it? And those questions still linger today. And frankly, they're only going to become more important as Bitcoin becomes more and more mainstream.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Dmitry Naskayes, and welcome to the channel White Russian Show. This channel called White Russian Show because where I'm from, the country called Belarus, and the second name for this is White Russia. So I'm White Russian. White Russian Show, welcome to my channel. This video is devoted for this interesting idea that I think personally that Bitcoin was created by the government. And I'm going to tell you why. Let's go.
At one point this weekend, you said that Bitcoin, and this was basically, you were asked, Charlie said Bitcoin's like rat poison. You were asked about that comment, and you said, well, it's probably more like rat poison squared. Charlie went on in the meeting to then basically call Bitcoin turds.
He is an expressive sort, isn't he? Maybe when he gets a little older, he'll mature.
I just want to ask you about that because it sparks so much controversy, and particularly on Twitter and some of the places where you might expect people who are trading in cryptocurrency to be pretty loud about what they heard. What is it about Bitcoin that gets you guys so fired up?
Well, when you buy a farm, you look at the crop every year and what prices are, and you decide whether it was a satisfactory investment. I mean, you look to the asset itself and what it produces for you. When we buy a business, we look at what the business earns and decide how we feel about it in terms of what we paid. But we are buying something that at the end of the period, we not only have what we bought in the first place, but we have something that the asset produced. And when you buy non-productive assets, all you're counting on is whether the next person is going to pay you more because they're even more excited about another next person coming along. But the asset itself is creating nothing. One of the interesting things, for example, is gold. If you go back to the time of Christ and you look at how many hours of labor you had to give up in order to buy an ounce of gold, and you take it forward to now, you'll find the compound rate maybe a tenth or two tenths of 1%. You know, and then you have to insure it during that time and make sure, you know, somebody doesn't steal it from you and everything. But it doesn't produce anything. And productive assets, you can pay too much for a productive asset. But I bought a farm in the 1980s, and every year look at how much it produced, the way of soybeans and corn. And at the end of that period, I've still got the farm, and I've gotten some significant income off of it, apartment house, operating business. But if you and I buy various cryptocurrencies, they're not going to multiply. They're not going to be a bunch of rabbits sitting there in front of us. They're just going to sit there. And I got to hope next time you get more excited after I bought it from you, and then maybe I'll get more excited and buy it from you. And actually, we can sit in a house by ourselves, and we can keep running up the price between the two of us. But at the end of the time, there's one Bitcoin sitting there, and now we got to find somebody else. And they come to an end. I mean,
that's a greater fool theory. That's what you're saying?
It's buying something because you expect the pool of people who want to buy it because they want to sell it to somebody else will grow. And you know, it's wonderful because it does create a rising price, does create more buyers, and people think, I've got to get in on this. And it's better if they don't understand it. That's the other thing about non-productive. If you don't understand it, you get much more excited than if you understand it. I mean, if you buy a bond that says it's going to pay you 4% a year, you're not going to get any pleasant surprises. She's going to pay you 4% a year. But if you can have anything you want to imagine. If you just look at something and say, that's magic, you can do it with shark's teeth or seashells or anything. And, you know, they did it with tulips in the 17th century in Amsterdam. And they'll do it again. I mean, people, they like to speculate. They like to gamble. And if you can get something, particularly if you have something half plausible going on, mm-hmm. If you had bought gold in 1942 and you say, we might lose the war and we might have to run off to some other country and, you know, so let's put our assets in gold. You would have less than a penny for every dollar you got from owning stocks. Less than a penny. Now, somebody calls that a store of value. I mean, I think they're delusionary.
Okay. Andrew has a question, too. Andrew.
Hey, Warren, related to this issue of Bitcoin, you saw that Goldman Sachs just last week announced that they were going to create a effectively a trading operation around cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in particular. You've been an investor in Goldman. What do you think of their decision to do that?
Well, they probably think that lots of people are going to get very excited about it. Well, and maybe already are, but that they think there's money to be made trading them. I don't think they're expressing an opinion on the ultimate value. I would be very surprised if the top partners of Goldman are selling their Goldman stock and putting it into Bitcoin. But I want to cover this subject now because my friend Charlie will come on at 8 o'clock and he'll tell him what he will say.
Well, that's my whole entire point. I do want to ask Charlie about it because I think when he talked about the turds, he was referring to this. He said if you're trading this, it's like watching other people trading turds and deciding you want to get a piece of that.
Well, you're not going to get me to comment on that.
Hopefully Charlie's not awake and
well,
not watching
right
now.
Well, the truth is people do trade on very crazy things over time. Imagine people selling their homes to buy a tulip in Amsterdam. If people think they're going to make money the next day, and worse yet, if they think somebody else that they know is going to make money and they aren't going to make money, it just draws people in. You know, I could whisper something on this program, and kind of the more sillier it was, the more it might react, because there's no quantitative limits. If you buy a stock, you say, well, I'll buy it at 15 times earnings, but I won't buy it at 20 times earnings. But when you get into something that doesn't produce anything, you know, there's no checkpoints. There's nothing to reference it to. It's just, it's gone up, so it'll keep going.
This theory claiming that the CIA created Bitcoin is a captivating narrative that intertwines skepticism towards government institutions, distrust in financial systems, and the complexities of emerging technologies. While the theory raises important questions about surveillance, control, and the future of finance, it, however, remains largely speculative and unsupported by concrete evidence. The allure of this theory lies in its ability to challenge established narratives and provoke critical thought about the nature of money and power in the digital age. While I think it's totally possible, even plausible, that the CIA created Bitcoin, I feel it was more likely created by a foreign adversary who then created the conspiracy theory that it was created by the CIA in order to throw people off the trail of who really created it. And I think China, or most likely Russia, are actually behind it.